On June 9, 2006, three inmates died at Guantanamo Bay Prison. The official investigation by the Naval Criminal Investigative Service concluded that the men had hanged themselves in their cells. But over the years, a number of questions have been raised about how these men allegedly killed themselves and the circumstances surrounding their deaths. Human rights attorney and Harper's contributing editor Scott Horton has been following the story. He spoke with us in 2010 about the Gitmo suicides, and he has now uncovered new evidence which challenges the official account of what happened that night and points to a possible cover-up. His latest article is in the June issue of Harper's Magazine. And Scott, welcome back to our show.
Great to be with you.
Who were the three detainees who died in 2006 in Guantanamo?
Well, they were two Saudis and one Yemeni. Al-Zarani is the one who is the subject of my new piece. He's the son of a Saudi brigadier general, and he's also a figure who was set to be released before his sudden death.
Do we know where they were captured and why? Well, were any of them charged with anything of importance?
None of them have been charged with anything. I think the United States, reviewing their files, found it really didn't have a case, which is the reason why they've been set to be released. They'd all been picked up either in Afghanistan or in Pakistan as part of a bounty program that the U.S. government had launched to sweep up suspicious-looking foreigners, particularly Arabs, who were found in the area.
Now, what's been the official story in the Naval Criminal Investigative Service report about how these men committed suicide?
The official story is that they committed a synchronized suicide in their cell that evening. Each of them had, according to the official narrative, put a cloth down their throats, fashioned a noose from bed sheets, and wrapped their hands and feet with cloth, then had attached the noose to the upper links of their jail and jumped, strangling themselves. And, you know, the problem with this from the outset, medical examiners we interviewed told us, is that there are no reported suicides that match this description in history, and a big part of the narrative is just physically not possible. So stuffing cloth down your throat is not a way anyone would commit suicide, and there's a gag reflex that sets in that would stop anyone from doing that. And in the new documents we have, one of the items is a report from the senior medical officer on duty that evening, who says that one of the prisoners died as a result of asphyxiation, which is to say the cloth stuffed down the throat caused his death, which is not the same as the official narrative of death by strangulation through a noose.
Now, the deaths were called asymmetrical warfare by U.S. officials when news of them first surfaced. What does that term mean?
Well, that's a term that was used at the outset of the war on terror to justify the deployment of heavy military assets to deal with terrorists. But the concept is, and this is a neoconservative concept, that these people don't have powerful weapons, but they'll use whatever they have at their beck and call, including their own lives, through suicide to attack the United States.
That's a kind of a strange theory, but okay. The Human Rights Center of UC Davis issued a report which concluded that the United States was doing something called dryboarding around the time of these deaths. What's dryboarding? Is it anything like waterboarding?
It's exactly like waterboarding. So waterboarding technique was designed to simulate a sensation of asphyxiation by dunking a head in underwater for a period of time. And dry boarding aims to accomplish the same sensations, but using a rag or a piece of cloth stuffed down the esophagus to do the same. Yeah. And what the University of California at Davis noted, that the descriptions of the way these three died in the presence of the cloth appeared to match almost exactly other reported instances of dry boarding, which was a technique being used by U.S. intelligence officers about this time.
Now, Scott, we have a real problem with this line, even though we're talking to you from London. We're going to take a brief break, and try to establish a better line, and then we'll come back because this is a really fascinating story. I'm sure our audience wants to know all the details. Stay with us. And we're back with Scott Horton, who's a contributing editor at Harper's and also a human rights attorney. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
Oh, much better connection. So we were talking about dry boarding. Now, is dry boarding seen as an acceptable alternative to waterboarding?
No, not at all. In fact, it would be categorized as torture for the exact same reasons. So it gives someone a sensation of death. And I think one of the issues surrounding it is if it's not properly administered, it can produce death. And I think that's the suspicion here. I mean, certainly the suspicion is not that that these were intentional homicides. The suspicion is that somehow this technique was not properly applied and it produced asphyxiation.
And it was part of the learned helplessness theory used by the CIA. How was that achieved, and what's the point of learned helplessness?
Well, I think this is a point on which the Associated Press has made some major breakthroughs in December of last year. We know the facility they were taken to. The Associated Press has told us this was being used by the CIA. They were running a program there that was designed to turn prisoners. And, of course, they had developed this learned helplessness program. So learned helplessness is a term. It's a term of art used by psychologists to describe a state of passivity in which people become susceptible to suggestion, or we might say programming, and getting people, many of these techniques, including waterboarding, cold cell, long time standing, and other psychological techniques were used to prepare people to get them to this state.
Which in which they were recruited perhaps to turn to work for the CIA. This area was called Penny Lane, although it also had been called Camp No in earlier stories.
That's right. The prison guards referred to it as Camp No, and that was No as in if anyone asks you if it exists, you should deny that. But the Associated Press has told us the CIA referred to it as Penny Lane.
And do we know why? Were they Beatles fans?
The other facility was called Strawberry Field, so I definitely suspect that there were Beatles fans involved.
We're learning more about what happened that night from Exhibit 25. What is that?
Exhibit 25 is a statement by a military policeman who was on duty that evening, who was Master at Arms Denny. And he describes his experiences, which amount to the last hours of life of al-Zahrani. He's called to escort al-Zahrani to a hospital. He finds al-Zahrani has already been removed and is in the clinic. He's puzzling about how that could have happened without a military escort. But then he reaches down and feels his pulse and discovers he's alive. He's not dead. So this report establishes that al-Zahrani was alive several hours after the point at which, according to the official narrative, he had died. And he notes it's strange because he's surrounded by all of these healthcare professionals, but no one is administering CPR or trying to revive him. And indeed, he notes one guard is wrapping cloth around his hands. Now, of course, according to the official CPR report, that was done by the prisoners as part of their alleged suicide. And here we see steps being taken that appear to be staging that. He then, with one of his colleagues, escorts him to the Naval Hospital in an ambulance, administering CPR, foamy orange blood gushes out. He delivers him to the hospital, and there he witnesses more surreal scenes, including the camp command calling and asking, "Is he dead yet?" And, you know, and his description points to real confusion that evening, particularly with the guards not really being clear if they're supposed to be staging a suicide of some sort or if they're supposed to be administering life support.
Now, wasn't Al-Zahrani 17 years old or so when he was picked up and sent to Guantanamo?
16, yes.
How old was he when he died?
23.
Exhibit 25, this new evidence, was redacted from the official NCIS report released to the public. How did you get your hands on it?
Well, in fact, the Exhibit 25, if you look at the report, there are three pages that are there in the place of Exhibit 25, and there are three pages just taken from other documents that make no sense. We found this document in a FOIA production connected with another report, and going into it and using Adobe Acrobat, we could unredact some of the redactions. And peeling back one label, we found Exhibit 25 stamped there at the bottom. So this was the missing Exhibit 25 document. And when you get into and start reading it and analyzing it, you realize that suppression was no accident, because this is a document that fundamentally challenges the government's narrative about what happened that evening.
Weren't there videos made of these CIA interrogations and when these men were sent to the detainee clinic the night they died? Do we know where those tapes are, and do we know whether it's likely they'll ever surface?
That's another important fact that emerges from this document. So Denny observes a camera team arriving on the scene and starting to film things, and then he sees the commander of the facility, Colonel Baumgartner, instructing them to stop taping right away. Another document that we've discovered notes that the tapes exist. So we know that there are videos of what happened that evening, and they have not been made public or disclosed.
Scott Horton won the National Magazine Award for reporting in 2011 for his story, The Guantanamo Suicides. His recent follow-up on the story appears in the June issue of Harper's Magazine, and we have links to the original article and my earlier conversation with him on our show page at WNYC.org. Scott, thank you so much for being on our show again.
It's great to be with you.